The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 8th of August, 2019. On the podcast today, I have James Draper, CEO of Bidstack, BIDS ticker there, of course, and Justin Wenschke, CEO of PubGuard. Recently acquired by the company. They talk about the reason for the acquisition and other progress at the company. Of course, James just come back from China. Also on the podcast, Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, covers Hargreaves Lansdown, some results out from them, Aviva and Cineworld. And Alan Green, we argue over lots of companies this week, ECR Minerals, Smart Metering Systems, Petrol Resources, Sativa Group, and Feedback. By the way, this was recorded just after Feedback did their fundraiser announcement, or they said there's a rumour apparently in the market, and they said, we are looking to raise funds. That's why we don't mention the fundraiser, and the share price has dipped quite significantly since that, so we don't mention that. So it may sound odd if you didn't mention it. Also, on the podcast, I have two lists for you, top five. You can see top 10 at voxmarkets.co.uk. Top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs. By the way, the most followed lists are worth looking at. If you see a company on there, featuring on there on a regular basis, and the share price really hasn't moved, you know, then it's worth doing some research, because basically it's a follow of money. Why do people follow companies? Because they're researching or buying the company. So it's a nice way in. Just check it out on the front page of voxmarkets.co.uk.
Are you tired of missing news about stock market companies you follow? The Vox Markets app helps investors stay ahead by making sure you never miss an important update. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is James Draper, CEO of Bidstack, and Justin Wenschke, CEO of PubGuard, of course, recently acquired by Bidstack. Guys, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Steve, for having us on.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I know it's supposed to happen yesterday, but James, you just come back from China with a bit of jet lag. And I've never had jet lag before until recently. I couldn't sleep for 4 days after coming back from Mexico. So I understand where it's like coming back from China. But was it all good in China? Why did you go out there, first of all? And was it all good?
So it was a UK-China trade mission that was set up by the UK gaming body, UKI. So we went out there as to meet a number of Chinese game publishers, developers, and various different sort of who's who, and really sort of to assess the Chinese landscape for our next phase of growth. We're very much obviously looking at all areas of the world we should be sort of positioning ourselves in. China is an obvious market for that. So it was my first visit to the place, and it was extremely beneficial. The types of people that we met there in particular that were of interest were, in China definitely, household name, very large publishers that also stretch across additional services that we were talking to. They have a great interest in what we're doing, both in China, but also across the rest of Asia, and some, I can't go into too much detail, but some are launching content over here in Europe, and we are a very logical partner for those guys. So we had the opportunity to present. It was a very well-organized event. So I was over there for 4 or 5 days, and it was back-to-back meetings throughout. And I'll say one thing, it's extremely easy to do business over there as a Brit over there, very well received. It's what we're doing is luckily of great interest to the people that we've met. So it was a very worthwhile trip. It's been a very busy period. So now when we last spoke, I was feeling somewhat jet lagged last time as well when I was in Cannes. So there's been an awful lot of things that have been going on behind the scenes. It's been a deliberate decision to not communicate too much to the market via podcast, as much as I do like talking to you and obviously communicating to the guys. I think it made more sense for us to go below water for a little bit, keep our mouth shut and just make some severe progress. I remember last time I mentioned about the fact that we have got a very aggressive sort of period of growth we're going through. We're trying to achieve 3 years worth of growth in 1 year. I would say that we are very, very happy with the progress we are making. The quality of the people that are coming into the company is just making the outputs go up faster, higher quality. We've also seen that, what we're trying to achieve in Q3, we are absolutely in line to achieve. And Q4, it's always been said that is go time, and we are extremely comfortable with that as well. So everything's going along as planned. So if I'm being quiet, it's not because I'm sitting on my hands, it's because we're getting up to stuff.
Okay. Well, the last significant news, of course, the acquisition of PubGuard. So what I want to do is I want to ask Justin about PubGuard. Obviously, there's no one better than him to tell us all about it and what it does and the stats behind that. And then we'll go into your reasoning behind acquiring it. So, Justin, thanks for coming to the podcast. Explain PubGuard. What's it about? Because I'd not really heard of it until BidStack acquired you. But so what do you do and you know, what significance do you have in the market there?
Yeah, so one of the biggest problems that digital publishers face is that the quality of the advertising that they're receiving is below par. So currently, we review up to about 2 billion ad impressions per day, and we see on average about 15% of that ad content falls below par. So it's either fraudulent or it's not hitting viewability standards, not loading blank or anything like that. And we realize from working many years in the digital sector, that the only time that there was any sort of light shone on this these type of issues was when something went critically wrong. So you start trending on social media because you're serving incredibly ineffective ad content to an incredibly sensitive demographic. But what we realised is that, you know, it's just the tip of the iceberg, really, for publishers, digital publishers, and for digital brands in general who host advertising. So what we offer is the ability for those digital brands to review every single ad impression that every single user sees, and then analyze it to make sure it's not popping up, redirecting, compromising brand standards, and so on. Through that analysis, we are able to not just, you know, remove critical ad content, which is damaging brands, but also help those brands to improve the performance of that ad content that goes onto their platform.
Yeah. And when you're approached by sort of BidStack there, well, obviously you must have thought it was a good fit.
Oh, yeah, 100% so, yeah. So to give you a bit of a backstory, you know, the jump in the way back machine. 4 years ago, we identified that, you know, there was a problem with the distribution of ads, and the publishers were the most affected of it. So what we did was we went out and we started working with publishers to build out our solutions on. Very early doors, we found ourselves quite magically, actually, over in LA and talking to very large sort of gaming brands about how we could help their digital properties and so on. They kept saying to us, well, you know, we have mobile applications, we have desktop websites, we've got mobile websites as well. But also, you know, the console market is the console ads that we're serving at the moment is a bit of a headache for us as well. And we were at that point, we were sort of, you know, hyper focused on building what is the most stable and scalable solution for the ad verification market. When the opportunity came up to work along BidStack, we realized that we could actually solve the problem universally. We can make sure that we can protect digital brands, users, ad revenues and so on across every digital touchpoint for, you know, gaming platforms and with their users and so on. So we absolutely leapt at the chance because we'd had demand for it previously, and it made a lot of sense for us.
Yeah, cool. Okay, well, James, back to you and your thought processes and how it came about, this acquisition.
A couple of things, really. The main reasons, and again, I want to be relatively cautious about what we share. We know that the likes of Anzu listen to this podcast, so hello to them. So we want to make sure that we don't want to share too much of the reasons behind it. But as a top line sort of overview, we've always said, and we continue to act towards, we are building out a group here that has the aim to become the biggest media owner in the video game sector. So if you want to activate your brand, a campaign into the world of video games, we are absolutely doing everything in a structured way to make sure that we are the de facto place to go to, if, whether or not that be on a natural placement in the environment, what we obviously term as native. If it is banner-related advertising on a video game advertising, well, on a forum, for example, anything within the ecosystem. If you're trying to get to a gamer, we want to become that that place you have to go to. So with that in mind, a lot of the spend to get to that particular audience will be digital, will be programmatic. So for us to be able to scan and make sure we can protect both the gamer and also the publisher, to guard the publisher, we thought PubGuard was the right sort of route to go down. We saw Justin and Chris, this has been in offing for, I think, 5 months. Yeah, it was a nod from Justin. So yeah, five months or so that we've been sort of working on doing a deal together. What we found as we popped the hood and looked underneath, we were actually talking to, both companies were talking to the same individual at the game developers themselves, coming with two different products that were both complementary and both well received. And part of the reason we went public in the first place was to utilize the paper that we have. So we outlined our vision of where we see the company going. We obviously showcased evidence that the public has not seen to Justin and to Chris and to their shareholders, Mercia, etc. And it was remarkably well received. They have bought into the vision, hence why they've taken pure stock. They wouldn't be doing that if they didn't believe that we would be getting to where we were setting out to get to. And on top of that, some of the, in the process, and this is why I want to be relatively careful, the process in which we are scanning the advertising copy, we have also got the ability through PubGuard to extract some profile data on the user. As such, we can build out a profile of the gamer. And I would love to give you some examples of it, because it's pretty interesting stuff, and I'll probably do it at our investor event. But I probably won't do it on this podcast now, because we listen to it over and over again. So it enables us to charge a higher CPM, because you can target specific individuals, and not just information we're extracting from the game publisher, but additional pieces that may be on that person's device or certain elements of their behavior we can target against. So it's a prevention, an ad for prevention piece for us, but on top of that, it enables us to expand our commercial offering. We're talking to the same person, so it gave us greater spread and greater array of products to talk about to the game publishers. And on top of that, you know, we very much like Justin and Chris, and Justin knows an awful lot of people across the video game market, and we felt we could work with him and work with Chris to build out this group. So that was kind of the main sort of focus point surrounding it.
Do you know what? It's nice to, I heard some, and I sort of saw that as well. In your last RNS, you said you want to be a significant owner of digital media in the video. And someone said, hang on, why has he stopped saying he wants to be the world's biggest? That worried some people.
No, that's when you start going through the RNS edits, you know? There's only so much I'm allowed to say. So, it gets pulled back a little bit. But I can tell you that everything we are doing is done in a very structured way. To reiterate what I was saying earlier again, we are executing a three-year plan in 1 year. We have to. There's certain things, well, I know I've obviously, I shouldn't do it. Occasionally I pop onto the forums and have a quick look, see what their sentiment's like, the bulletin boards. So it's good for your stress levels. So I had a quick peruse, and I know there's a few people out there that are sort of running through calculations based on the Peterhouse note, and that's absolutely fine. But it's fair to say we have not reset the number. We have not issued anything which would sort of suggest that we're not completely comfortable. So we are working towards ensuring that BidStack group is going to absolutely become the biggest media owner in the world of video games. So we're on track. We're very comfortable with how things are going as a whole. As I say, growing up, getting the right talent is absolutely important. Sometimes it makes sense for us to go and acquire companies to get the talent as well as the technology, as well as the customers. And it's actually probably worth saying as well, actually, as acquiring PubGuard as a going concern, it actually comes with active clients, some of them actually renewed off the back of the news as well, which is
great. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it made an awful lot of sense for us, but if I tweak the wording ever so slightly sometimes, it's because certain people have asked me to, so not because I'm changing my tact and thought process. And I can tell you one thing, that there is no change in terms of how I outlined the journey. Q3 is putting an awful lot of things together. Q4 is execution on those things which we put together. So it is, and the number's not been changed. I can't be clearer than that without getting in trouble. So I would say that everyone's very comfortable with how the company is set up.
Yeah, I just like to add on to that as well, that I don't think I've told you this before, but we were in our sort of like courting phase, I suppose. We had a fair few sort of companies at the table in terms of acquisition, including sort of big brand West Coast US company, also we had secured VC investment, had sort of heads from UK VCs and so on, and we were deciding what options that we were going to take. And you know, as part of that, obviously we're talking to our clients, and you know, when we're you know, explaining to them, you know, the different sort of routes where we're taking the company, what the opportunities are, and so on, resoundingly, you know, coming into the BidStack group is a big draw for a lot of the guys. And as I say, while we were actually going through the entire process, one of our clients renewed for a year, almost immediately. I think it was about 24 hours after we had a talk about what we're currently doing, what we're looking to do.
Can you say which client?
Sorry.
Okay, well, listen, James, I'll ask you some of the questions that I understand you can't give much detail, but a couple of people have said, is the news expected on sort of trade deals, demand side or supply side stuff soon? I don't know what detail you can give on that, really.
Yes, I mean, we are running test campaigns and all the DSPs that you would expect us to be on, ones that I've alluded to in the past. So we are in the phase of running test campaigns with those. The reason, it's got to be said, what we are doing, there is no manual and go and get off the shelf and go and write, this is how you do it. It is all net new. So ourselves, our friends over at the likes of Anzu and Adverti and Admix, all going through the same challenges. It is, the technology part is almost, everything has to come together in one particular way. So what you don't want to do is stockpile too much real estate too quickly. And you want to always negotiate and agree when you put pen to paper for the real estate, you want to do so when you're in the best possible position to get the best terms possible, obviously. Now, I'm going to say this in a certain way because I know that the likes of the CRO of EA listens to this. So I won't go any further than that. On the demand side, as mentioned, this is net new ad format. So at the moment, the way that it's being worked on is that we're taking money from the likes of the out-of-home guys, the broadcast guys, the digital teams as well. In the future, there will be a bit like you're seeing on a media plan, there will be a like an in-game guy and girl in an ad agency that you would go through, and they do all the buying of this type of inventory. But that doesn't exist at the moment. You know, I think I mentioned before, was it? There are certain massive holding groups, advertising holding groups, agency holding groups that have only got one video game expert in the entire group out of like 130,000 people. So it's everything's very embryonic. And then on the technology side, it's again, we're beating new ground. Like as we're going through and developing bits and pieces for this, you've got to do so in a way that you are being entrusted by a game publisher to put your technology into their environment, in a live environment, in a paid for product. And you've got to make sure that that technology doesn't disrupt what is going on for the end user. It's going to be completely seamless. And at the same time, you want to do it so the game publisher internally doesn't have to assign a couple of individuals to go and look over the ad content which is running through. So that's why we built our ad console. That's why we've been going down the route of the SDK. Initially, when we float up, we had an API, and we've moved to an SDK based solution, and that was for a number of reasons. One of which I've already covered before, so it is what it is. Is the tracking pixel scenario? You can only drop one of those into a gaming environment with an SDK. You can't do it via a bridge API. So that had to be created, tested, and we've only been floated up for less than a year, and that's an awful lot of work to do in a short period of time with no handbook to go to. There's other things as well I want to sort of just cover off really briefly, right? So just because we're not RNSing certain pieces doesn't mean there's not pieces of commercial stroke technology breakthroughs that we're making, because not all the time are we the only party involved. Obviously, if it's a commercial understanding, it is a collaborative understanding. Both parties have to agree to announce it, and certain other parties that we may or may not have got agreements in place with, because of their own timelines, they don't want to announce their side yet, for example. So what we can't do is go and breach that trust to try and fill what is, like a 2-month silent period, which we've done on the market. So believe me when I say this, the work that's been achieved in the last 2 months has been substantial. The team is really sort of well-oiled now, and it's really come together beautifully. The additions of like Simon Gosling and Rob Dembitz have just added to that, and bringing Justin and Chris into the team in particular, those guys, has been wonderful for us. And there are many, many things bubbling away that in time, and you know the timelines are laid out, right? Q3's I've said, and what I'm allowed to say that it's putting things together. Q4 is go time. Yes, I keep getting messages on text and WhatsApp and LinkedIn and emails, and people sort of going, you said it'd be stuff in Q3. We're still in Q3. There's plenty of Q3 to go. There'll be plenty of things that will be the coming together that will happen in that time frame, as I've mentioned. You know, it's nothing's changed. It's just some things happen that can be talked about today, some things can be spoken about in the future. So it's everything's on track. We're very happy, and everyone's working very well and very hard.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's talk about one other thing. I mean, it seems like it's all going well there. One thing that came up when a couple of people, you've obviously probably got it 10 times more than I did, but a couple of people flagged up the Anzu raising 6.5. They're seen as, I suppose, a competitor. I don't know where they are in relation to you. Apparently, you were ahead of them. But first and foremost, I thought, oh, hang on, that's not good. Then I thought, hang on, no, it is quite good, actually, because it basically validates the concept. It shows there's investor appetite for in-game advertising. But what's your thoughts on that Anzu deal?
Again, we know Anzu listened to this, and hence why they announced their verification piece just after I mentioned it on the podcast last time. So, congratulations to them on the deal. You're right. First of all, it points out that investors, and it's not just investors. We're not just looking at people who've just have got a day job doing something else and then just like the sound of it. We're talking about people who are strategic investors from their point of view. So it's very impressive. We know they're making an awful lot of noise, which is wonderful for all parties involved. It's the more people talking about what we do as an ad format, the better. Fine, as long as we win out in the end. And one side, yes, it's brilliant that you've got the likes of WPP and Axel Springer coming into this particular piece. Great. But I would say this. One thing which before we pivoted into the world of video games, we had a large amount of research we put in, because we had investors that already backed the digital out-of-home venture long before we came to the public market. And those people who invested, entrusted me to execute on what we outlined in terms of the digital out-of-home journey. And it took an awful lot of research into the video game space to convince me, as well as others, to move the business out of that market when we were just starting to break through it into a new space. So we started looking at the likes of Massive Inc., Double Fusion. That's why we added John Epstein to the advisory board. He was the president over there. And IGA, in-game advertising. And we wanted to find out what went right, what went wrong with those companies, and because they no longer exist, right? So Massive Inc., as mentioned, in 2006, exit to Microsoft for $187 million, which then created this gold rush where Double Fusion and IGA popped up and started to sort of gun after the in-game advertising space. It excited investors that Microsoft was sort of doubling down on that particular piece. It looked like a great deal. It was a great deal, definitely, for the shareholders of Massive Inc. And the guys over there, you know, Mitch and Catherine, they're wonderful people and did a great job. And we met their old sales guys and Derek, their old lawyer, and all this sort of thing. But what they lost with that deal is that they lost neutrality. So by aligning themselves to Microsoft, obviously Sony didn't want to play ball with them, nor did Nintendo. And it was a great exit, but it wasn't well received as well within. It's a completely separate story. I'll bore the hell out of you over an entirely new podcast on why that kind of went down. The panel was rejected by the Microsoft teams, the Xbox teams internally when it got gobbled up. But I'll come back to my point. They lost neutrality, so no one else wanted to work with them from outside of that. Now, I don't know the intricacies of the deal as such, but from when I looked at it, I saw two things. One, which was wonderful. It proves that there is interest from big potential strategic companies to get involved in this space. And also, great, that means that Anzu have lost their neutrality. So Dentsu Aegis, Publicis, Omnicom, those sort of guys aren't going to go and pump money into an asset which is going to be to the benefit of one of their rivals, WPP. So it's a great deal. And undoubtedly, it will make sure that company and those guys go forward strongly, and congratulations to them. However, one of our key things always to win and become the biggest is to make sure we stay as neutral as possible for as long as possible. And there have been opportunities for us, for this business, that have not been shared with the market for us to lose a little bit of neutrality. And the moment you do that, you do exactly what Massive Inc. did, and that is not part of our strategy. We want to work with Dentsu. We want to work with WPP. We want to work with Publicis. We want to work with Omnicom. We want to work with Brands Direct. We do not want to be told by one of our investors who we can and can't work with, and we don't want to limit our commercial scope. So that's my take on it.
Yeah, understood. Makes a lot of sense, actually. So is there anything else, James, you can share that you haven't already, or Justin, that you know, you can talk about that I haven't asked?
Justin, I promise you, there's so much I'd love to share. you know, there is so much I'd love to share.
Okay. Well, listen, let's go on.
Real quick, I know you're about to come on to your three questions, the three points. The thing for me is Gamescom's this month. Gamescom is significant. So E3's tee up. So a lot of first time meetings at E3. Some are pretty advanced. And you've got Gamescom. Just want to sort of, as a takeaway for everyone, is that the timeline of Q3 and Q4, as always mentioned, hasn't changed. Okay? And the end goal of what we're aiming to do, 3 years worth of work in one, hasn't changed. Everything is as we already outlined. And I think Justin's hopping up down his chair. He wants to have a quick mention something as well.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I just wanted to touch upon the last point about sort of general market intent and so on. I mean, new digital frontiers are absolutely massive at the moment. So my background's in the sort of in-app space, but obviously I've been across digital and various different platforms for a while. And with the restrictions on tracking in your sort of classic digital mediums, desktop, mobile, web, and so on, the new frontiers of mobile and in-game and so on, because of the ability to you know, look at sort of potential retargeting and so on via SDKs, and the ability to actually have like a true audience extension. A lot of people in the dynamic creative optimization space and the data management platform space and so on are really starting to feel the pinch from, you know, larger companies clamping down on the tracking sector. So yeah, it makes 100% sense that you know, the focus is the digital frontiers and how to align those different platforms.
Yeah. Okay, James, anything else over three reasons?
Let's just do three reasons. One, timeline is as stated. Justin is purely incentivized by stock, and it's fair to say that Justin's seen our plan and bought into that. So,
100%, yeah.
And on top of that, we're in very much a period where there's an awful lot of activity. So you will see everyone's aligned, and there is a lot of very interesting pieces coming together. So I'll be able to share more soon, I'm sure.
Excellent stuff. Justin, James, thanks for chatting to us. And like you say, more news coming up. So no doubt we'll be catching up very soon. Thanks a lot, fellas.
Cheers.
Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Very good. Thanks. Very good.
Right, so what's happening in the larger cap space, Chris, news-wise?
Well, too much is going on. Still in the midst of earnings season, 1,001 companies reporting around the world, loads in the UK as well. But, you know, we've got to start with Hargreaves Lansdown. Obviously, familiar name in the financial sphere. Probably lots of listeners are clients. For full disclosure, I'm a client as well. I have my SIP with them. And I have to say, operationally, they seem okay. But obviously, they've been caught up in a variety of issues over the last 6 or 12 months. Put a lot of people into Neil Woodford funds, which are now suspended. They did apologise over that up front and centre on their numbers today. But certainly it's been impacting, I think, the public perception of the company. And clearly they were also battling alternative providers, maybe with lots of passive offerings and stuff like that. So kind of interesting seeing the numbers today. Profits were up, just a single, you know, mid-single digit percentage, 5.7% odd. Assets under administration were up, again, by a similar percentage. And interim dividend was also, the dividend was also raised by a similar percentage. However, the new business flows, which for this sort of business, the way it is, of course, the new business coming in is the real insight into how they're going to perform in terms of numbers and everything over the next little while. Because what you do is you get the business in, maybe it costs you a bit of money, but then obviously you try and take fees off it and everything else over the fullness of time. The new business flows were down, and they were down 5-odd%. And I think clearly reflects a lot of those issues. And as those numbers are up to the end of June, and a lot of obviously the Neil Woodford stuff and whatever have sort of hit in more recent weeks, one wonders what the new business flows numbers are going to look like next time around. I would imagine possibly a little bit worse. So shares have bounced today. They're still below 20 quid when I last looked, and they've been as high as sort of 24 year to date. So kind of the thing's been sliding away. Bit of a bounce today, probably on the fact that, not that they apologised about the Neil Woodford incident, but the fact that profits went up and dividends went up, and that's obviously a good thing rather than a bad thing. But I'm wondering whether there's more issues here to come. It's on a big old rating as well, you know, deep into the 20-somethings PE. I'm not buying it myself. I'm avoiding this one, despite being a client who's actually reasonably happy with them.
Yeah, well, do you know what? Their share price rose quite nicely, you know, up until, you know, obviously up and down, but I mean, it had an upward trend up until sort of September 2018. And since then, it's been a bit random. You know, it's jumped down again, down to 16 quid, or close to that, 7 quid, then back up to 24 quid. It's like in July, then back down to 18 quid. It's all over the place. It's almost like saying, where's it going next? You know, so
that's right.
Yeah, I would like some, you know, uniformity or some sort of pattern in somewhere they can recognise. It's all over the place at the moment. So that alone just shows it's a bit of unknown going on, you know?
That's it. And obviously, there's a bit of interlink with the markets. We know the markets have been more volatile recently. You know, last year, it's interesting, as you say, they peaked in September last year. Obviously, you then had an emerging market crisis. You then had all general global stock markets were a bit iffy the latter month or two of 2018. So, you know, there's a little bit of reflection in that. Clearly, they do clip fees from portfolios. People are more inclined to invest money with them in excitable conditions. So there's no doubt a bit of impact from that. But I think some of these other issues which have afflicted them, I think prospectively are going to hold back the shares. My feeling, the way it sort of works out, is that the share derates, and it derates to something a bit more sensible in terms of valuation. And it's not going to need, you know, sort of special new news about the FCA saying this and that or whatever. I think the share is going to derate, and hence why I'm avoiding it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think a bit of uncertainty here may drag it lower. Cool. And there is a lot of that around, isn't there? I genuinely feel what I'm annoyed at, because a while back I bought a silver and gold ETF. This must be 6 months back now. Mm. And I thought, okay, I'm you know, there's uncertainty on the horizon, and nothing happened for like 3 or 4 months, and I got rid of them. I just wanted the funds or something else. And I see gold has gone nuts now. I should always have a bit of gold there in the portfolio.
Yeah, no, I would absolutely concur. A little bit of gold it goes a long way, and it's a good mixer. It does things in your portfolio at different times to other investments. You know, you can have the debate about stocks versus bullion or ETF or whatever. You know, that's a whole other debate. But having some exposure at some level, I think, is smart. So, yeah, something to think about. Never too late, but probably not the day to buy today.
Well, I didn't realise the central government's not only are they sort of, lowering interest rates, but they're also buying a record amount of gold. China and Russia especially, this first quarter, apparently, they bought a record amount of gold. So that says something in my mind.
That's right. Absolutely. I mean, obviously, the UK dumped a load of gold a little while ago when Gordon Brown was Chancellor, you may recall.
Gordon, yeah, the low.
Gordon. Great call there. Great call, Gordon. And I'm sure he's struggling now. I'm sure not. Yeah. Anyhow, so the UK and others, yeah, you're right. Some central banks are selling, but most are buying. And it is more focused on what I would call the more long-sighted emerging market countries. Russia, China are two very good examples. There are others. Net-net, central banks are buying gold at levels not seen for a generation. So kind of interesting. And, you know, it's all to do with the fact that on the other side of the equation, you've got central banks reducing interest rates, which is, you know, a reflection of where they think the economy is going or what they need to do. But, you know, obviously that's another level indicative of some broader issues about an economy, a global economy that's just got too much debt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous. What's next, Chris? What else is
there? If we moved on from Hargreaves Lansdown and financial services, let's still talk about an insurance company, Aviva. Insurance is always a difficult area to look at. It's not easy from an accounting perspective, but I've kind of worked my way through some of the numbers. Today's first half numbers from Aviva actually look all right. Sure, profits haven't gone up very much. They've edged the dividend up as well, which is a good sign. But I think this is more about where this company's going, because I think Aviva, most would agree, has kind of disappointed. It's been boring, it's been dull, it's been not quite done what many people hoped it would do. And then they've brought in a new CEO in recent months. He started to change the business a bit. He's got a big investor day coming up in November where I think they will announce some further changes. But he's already announced some changes to the UK business, the structure of it. Today's announcement, he's looking at the Asian businesses that they own and actually whether to sell them or not. And all of this stuff is good little building blocks towards a company that's changing. Now, Aviva, when you look at it, it is a value stock. There's no doubt about that. It trades below book value. That it's not the only financial company clearly to trade below book value, but I'd say it's kind of a sort of a sensible one. As I said, profit was slightly up, dividend was slightly up. It yields 7%. Even better, it actually generates enough cash to pay that dividend. So, you know, when I look at it, there's kind of, even though insurance does have some unpredictability about it always, you know, you go back to the global financial crisis, and that was certainly true. I think Aviva has some angles to it. And actually, I like the stock here. A small positive move off today's numbers. It's fallen down with the market in the last 2-3 weeks. I think that's more of an opportunity than a threat. I think this one's a good one, actually, and I like the sound of what they're doing here. So, bit of yield, bit of below book value. I can make it work. I'm hoping that the November Investor Day is going to be a bit of a catalyst in terms of further actions and further sort of focuses of the business.
Yeah, do you know what? Yeah, the share price is bouncing at a higher low than it did back in December, which is that big sell-off. But, you know, I'd be tempted to wait a little bit. It's still in a downtrend at the moment. It needs to sort of settle. And at the moment, do you know what? I do think at the moment that we are, that sell-off we just had, I think it's done and dusted now, I think. But there's always a bit of nerves jittery, isn't it? Jangling nerves after a big sell-off. People are a bit worried. But I think, you know, I think we'll grind a bit higher here, you know? Because what's changed? I do you know what I noticed earlier on? That China and Japan are now doing it. They're having talks for the first time in 7 years. I think that shows signs that, you know, President Xi there and the economy is hurting a bit. They've got that demonstrations and rebellions going on in Hong Kong. I think he wants to try and calm the waters a bit, you know. And they did say they may be meeting up, Xi and Trump, in September. They've got a meeting scheduled. So let me meet. So and I, you know, and like I say, it's part of Trump's game as well. But I think we've had a sell-off, and someone said on CNBC yesterday, if you look, Trump does this every now and again, shakes up the market like this, and then makes positive sounds within a couple of weeks of the market being shaken up, you know, because he doesn't like to destabilise the stock market, because that's his champion, isn't it? But
Precisely.
So I think now, I think we may grind a bit higher here. So,
I think that's fair. You know, Trump's, if he wants to win the 2020 election, a trade war is not the way to do it. You get a few rally to the flag votes in. That's certainly true. But for those that you get in, you lose about 10 times of that, because people are impacted by a slower economy, and that isn't good. And yeah, I agree. I think this is part of a game. It's games within games. My only observation is playing high stakes diplomatic poker with the Chinese. Yeah, you need big nerve to do that. I think I'd rather just strike a sort of a tentative deal this side of the election, stick it under the carpet, and then see what happens after November 2020 in terms of the election result and everything else.
Mm-hmm, marvellous stuff. Okay, cool. What's next? Anything else?
Just a quick one on Cineworld. Cineworld, obviously, I've got a Cineworld near me. I'm sure many listeners have as well. And it's a fine experience to go there. You know, it's a nice place, well kitted out. You know, lots of expensive popcorn and whatnot selling there as well. But Cineworld, the company, they had a nice business in Europe and the UK, obviously, as well. They did a big splurge in the States just over a year ago, massively indebted the company. They said, look, basically, we're taking European best practice and applying it to American cinema. They bought a company over there. They saw big opportunity. You know, since then, they've had to have a money raising in order to finance it. No great surprise to that. The shares have cratered, broadly speaking, because you've now got a bunch of debt on the balance sheet. And unsurprisingly, cinema is not an effortless growth industry. You know, there's some structural issues there, the rise of streaming and everything else. And obviously, you're susceptible to the cycle of cinema releases. Sometimes you get some great films that everybody wants to go and see, and sometimes not. And so you look at today's numbers from Cineworld, they're talking about a debt reduction. That's true. However, when I looked in detail, they were also making disposals, which helped fund that debt reduction. So, you know, again, cash flows perhaps not as hot as people would have thought. If you look at the earnings, EBITDA, which, you know, people would criticize as an earning measure, but they said EBITDA was down 11%, which again is not good. They blamed the film release schedule. Seems a little bit of a thin excuse. I'm wondering whether they've bitten off more than they can chew. They've got a lot of debt here still. It's well over 3x net debt to EBITDA ratio, which the banks will be, you know, watching closely. I'm still not impressed by this one. I just wonder whether they've shifted what was actually a nice cash generative European business into one where they've lumped a bunch of US debt onto it, which is not hot. So yeah. This one, I think the shares have been sliding. I think it was £4 earlier this year. I think it's £2.50, £2.60 now. Not good.
Yeah, and do you know what? When you think of the business model, I'm not impressed by it, I'm not appealed by it, it's attracted to it, I mean, because when you think of it, by its very nature, cinemas have to be in quite expensive areas, they have to be in busy areas, you know, central towns, central cities, whatever, you know, very accessible. Plus, like you say, they've got to compete with everything else, like Netflix and all this kind of stuff. So the cinemas I go to at the moment, in where I am, so they're very nice, they've got reclining seats and all that stuff, big seats, you know, but I often go there, even with popular films. I went to see The Lion King with the kids last weekend, and even that was like, what I'd say, half full. And you think, that's a big film, and because it's just been released. And you think, if you are reliant on constantly, you know, having to supply blockbusters, it's not going to happen. You know, blockbusters, no, by their very nature, come along once a year, if that, you know, so it's just highly reliant on other factors, isn't it? Like I said, the place they have to be, the movies they have to show. And then, you know, like I said, when you're sitting in the cinema sometimes and it's a half well-known film and it's not even half full, you think, wow, how do they make money here?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, you've got to refurb. They're talking a lot about refurbing the US cinemas they bought. Absolutely not. I get the idea. The idea is you buy, you know, rubbishy old US cinema chain, you bring it up to European standards, and you go for it. The trouble is, 20, 30 years ago, that would have been a golden idea. It would have worked very well. Yeah. Today, it's a changed world, and I'm wondering whether they've been off more than they can chew here, and I can't get excited about the shares. So, you know, one for the experts at most, but I'm not holding them.
They've got to spend a lot of money, and it's reliant on many other factors outside their control. And do you know what? The audience is changing, like you say. And my kids, for example, they are 6 and 9. They do not watch TV. They watch YouTube, and we'll drag them to the cinema now and again, but they don't watch TV at all. So the cinema wouldn't come on the radio unless we dragged them to the cinema. It's a change in audience. It's nice to go to cinema, but like I said, it's you know, it's hardly got a moat, is it? Well, I suppose the moat is people don't want to spend too much on you know, building a cinema. So maybe that's it. The costs are high, but that's it. Cool, marvellous stuff. Thanks for that, Chris, and we'll catch up next week, fella.
Sounds the plan. Sounds good.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications, trying to push some more rubbish on me. What you got this week, Al?
For heaven's sake, Justin, this is too much, mate. No, these are.
Telling me it's too much.
These are considered opportunities.
Very considered, and
I own shares in two of the
None
companies
of
we're going to talk about today. So there you go. What can I say?
Okay, I'll try and guess which ones. Right, you own shares in. Don't tell me, but I'll try and guess. All right.
Okay.
I'm going to treat this like it's a new series of Dragon's Den on. Okay, coming out apparently on Sunday. So I find the Dragon's Den people very arrogant. I mean, basically, unless you have a viable, profitable business with some big contacts already buying off you, they won't take a stake. And even then, they basically rip off your business off you for a reduced rate in some way. So it's no risk in it for them, pretty much. But you pitch to me, Al, and I'll say whether I'm in or out, all right?
Well, I like some of the ideas on Dragon's Den, but like you, I find them all pretty arrogant. And actually, I can't stand watching it. It's just really great. I do, some of the ideas that come up there are pretty original. So that's always good. You know, it's good to see innovation, as it were. So anyway, the first one I'm going to talk to you about today is ECR Minerals, epic code ECR. This is a mining and exploration company. Well, they're in the exploration phase at the moment, and they have a number of license areas, primarily focused in the Victoria region in Australia, and also the Yilgarn Craton region, which is one of the most fertile regions in the world for mining for precious metals and base metals. Now, there's been a series of developments through 2019 with ECR Minerals. I should add at this point that ECR market cap is currently 4.4 million shares, trading around a penny. And they had several placings last year, and they are fully funded through to the middle of next year. So they've got a year's worth of funding still in play right now as they develop these assets. And that's quite a rare thing for a small mining company of this size to say. So that's a key factor in my book. So Victoria, there are a number of gold prospects there. They have the Avoca, the Baylisten, Maumbal, Timor, and Kresik prospects. It's well documented that Newmont Mining, which is a mining giant in Australia and around the world, have a license area adjacent to the Baylisten and Maumbal licenses. But ECR are working through these licenses and they're developing each prospect, and they have developed a system for bagging and identifying when they take the samples from the site. They've developed a system for bagging and identifying the amount of gold in each bag, and it's something that's been underwritten by the mining authorities and the experts in the region, which is worth noting. So yesterday they announced an update on the Timor project, and the samples that were taken from Shaw and Anglo-Saxon regions within the Timor project's license area, they identified 22.6 grams per ton and 26.3 grams per ton, respectively, which is pretty healthy. That's pretty good, and it's in line, you know, more or less with the other testing that they've done on the license areas in the Victoria region. They also have an interest in Argentina with the Sierra de las Minas gold project, and also in the Philippines with the Dangley gold project there. As they've gone through this process, focusing back on Australia again, the progress has also been part funded by the Australian government. They received $171,000 R&D refund, and they're going through and developing these ongoing. So the company's worth 4.4 million, 1p. It's fully funded for a year. The directors have also subscribed for shares in the placing last year. So this to me is an ongoing project, and clearly for me, it's probably the pick the small cap miners on the AIM market right now, simply because it's got the funding in place and it's got it's not just focused on one project. And I think that's the problem with a lot of mining companies. They're kind of one trick ponies. They have a single project, and if it works, great. If it doesn't, then the company's worth nothing. ECR Minerals have a multitude of projects. Go to the website ecrminerals.com, and that'll tell you all you need to know. But that's it, ECR Minerals.
ECR Minerals. I like the fact it's gold at the moment. Do you know what?
Gold. Yep.
I'm kicking myself. Not right now, but a few months back, I bought a gold and silver ETF. Right. And I just expecting the downturn to happen, but nothing happened. But now I sold them out of impatience. And now they've rallied like crazy, haven't they? And I do believe it's a way forward. I need to get back into gold. I like the fact they've got cash. That's the problem with small miners.
Yeah, obviously. It is.
But what I want to do now is, I spoke to Hummingbird Resources. You know, they're producing gold at the moment. They've had a couple of issues at the start of the year, which are now behind them. They've got a second ball mill coming on place. They are producing and they're cash flow positive. And I quite like them. And I was going to buy and I didn't. And the podcast went out. And they rose by 10% off the back of the podcast. Because I just think at the moment, with, the US, the Fed devaluing, they will be devaluing, I think. There's another chance of a rate reduction. Gold is going to rally again. And that will produce more market uncertainty. And gold is where to be, And I haven't got any gold in my portfolio, which is silly. I should have just held on, I should have just held on to that ETF I had, but I sold it. I like gold. I like the fact they got the thing, but I'd go for a producer now. I'd definitely go for a producer.
I think, ECR really, it's the irony is that they're identifying what they refer to as nuggety gold samples, and these literally are small and large nuggets. And adjacent to the I think it's the Kresik prospect, a local TV company filmed a documentary about people looking for gold. And there was the company one of the individuals in the little film clip actually picked up this huge gold nugget. So through the bagging system that they're using to assess each sample, they're identifying these nuggets and clearly it's the processing's still got to be done, but when it's coming out of the ground and it's that easy to get at, that's pretty exciting stuff. Really you're then reducing your net cost to get the stuff to market if it's coming out of the ground like that. So anyway, that's where it is. It's all on the website. Go and have a look at these.
I'm
stuff.
On the website, and I'm seeing that Craig Brown only holds 0.6% of stock, which is quite disappointing for a microcap. That's quite disappointing. 0.6%. That, I'd want to see, for a small cap below 5 million, you want to see, the CEO own more than, 3% really, 3% more. Because that gives me confidence, if that's the thing, if it's potential here, why wouldn't they want to share in that potential as a CEO? That always gets my goat a little bit, go on, Craig, buy some more shares. And that will help it, I think. But there we are. Cool.
Good point.
All right, what's next?
So previously I think the last time we spoke about this one was last year, in fact. But I've kind of kept an eye on it. I should say at this point, I have shares in ECR Minerals. I don't have shares in this one. But
I was going to say, you have shares in ECR Minerals. You don't have shares in this one, though.
No, that's right. But it's one that's been on my watch list. Well, I can't own shares in everything. I've got a finite portfolio, unfortunately.
But I was going to guess what shares you had shares in. And you just told me.
There you go. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So this is Smart Metering Systems. So this is a company with a £500 million market cap. So it's a different ball game altogether. But Smart Metering Systems were growing nicely up to a few years ago, and then there were some issues with the first generation of smart meters, which weren't as weren't quite as smart as
they weren't
as,
smart. No, it's a trouble. They don't adapt. Talk about the meters may not be smart, but the share price is definitely not clever at the moment, is it? It's all time low.
Well, it isn't. It's an all-time low, which is why I picked it out. I'll just recap on what the company does. But you know, as the name implies, smart metering systems. Although clearly the first generation ones were thick metering systems. But anyway, there you go. Advanced smart metering systems for gas, electricity, energy management, and data collection. An automated data reading and data gathering service. But the company is also one area it's involved in is developing a national EV charging infrastructure, you know, which that interests me. Clearly, where we're going with electric cars at the moment, charging points are all the rage. So this is a national infrastructure on the back of the monitoring system they have. So presumably, if you have an electric vehicle, you can plug that in, and with your account number, you can probably get a single point account where you can have your phone energy costs and your smart vehicle energy costs wherever you're plugging around the country. But that's just an aside. The company issued a trading update on July 31st, and they said the first half of 2019 was in line, but the annualized recurring revenues, and this is obviously key. This is where the existing clients provide recurring revenue. We're up 14% at 86 million, ahead of expectations. So that's a key factor when you're looking for a cash cow, and in these uncertain times, we're looking for companies that are generating cash and also have a dividend yield too. And I should say at this point that smart metering systems does offer a dividend yield of 1.3%, which obviously is another significant factor. The company has 50 million cash in the bank. It's also got undrawn banking and future internal cash generation facilities of 183 million. So it's well funded. There are over 1 million smart meters now in circulation, and the company has acknowledged that the second generation of smart meters are being rolled out now, which should hopefully be more intelligent than the first set. But that's an aside. The fact is that the company's trading in line, and its annualized recurring, or the ARR, is actually ahead of expectations. And that was mentioned by the chief exec, Alan Foy, who has been a chief exec with the company now for a number of years, that this recurring revenue base was building ahead of expectations. And that's a key factor in my book. So shares are on a year low. What do the brokers say about it? Broker Peel Hunt at the start of August a few weeks ago reiterated its buy recommendation with a 735p target. Liberum also reiterated their buy recommendation with a 900p price target, and Barclays are equal weight with a 650p price target. Either way, they're all well ahead of where we are now. And given where the company are, given that we heard about this trading update literally a week ago, I think this is, at a year low, this could be a nice little company to buy into, because if that revenue starts to, or if the revenue continues, I would expect that we'll see the share price start to turn around and build again in the right direction.
Yeah, I think, they're headed for a fall. When you call something smart, straight away that you're headed for a fall there, because, like I said, they came out, I know Martin Lewis, money saving givers, talked about these systems being ridiculously unsmart, and they can't learn, they can't adapt, and you can't transfer from one network to another network. But it's a bit too big for me, but and not that compelling. But SMS, nice ticker. That's it.
Okay.
But no, do you know what? It's a bit oversold. We'll be interesting to see if they get some support here, because it's just broken down below previous support. Previous support was like 480. Now down 471. Of course, we've had a bit of a global sell-off in the last week, so maybe marked down on sentiment. But
I think a lot of mid-cap stocks have been knocked back by sentiment. Well, I say mid-cap, this is still a small cap, really. But a lot of stocks have been knocked back by the general sentiment, and people have left the market. And obviously, trading volumes are light at the moment. They don't really reflect where we're going to be, say, in 2 to 3 months' time. Once we're sort of back and think of it again. But regardless, this company is potentially a cash cow, and clearly with any stock you're looking to buy in at the right time, buy low, sell high. But if there's a decent dividend on the way, and the dividend yield has gone up from a year ago, so it's now 1.3%, then it could be a small cap that's worth buying and holding on to.
Marvellous, could be. SMS there. What's next, Alan?
Okay, we have spoken about this company too. In fact, at the start of the year, and they've progressed nicely since then. Sativa Group is the name of the company. S-A-T-I is the EBIT code. Now, this company is currently worth 32 million market cap, and it is a cannabis or a CBD company with a number of operations both in the UK and investments into Canada, Switzerland, and Germany. Share prices trade as high as 10p on the year, as low as 4.3p, currently trading 6.1p. The company, as I say, it has two key operations that it wholly owns in the UK, which is George Botanicals and Fida Vista Laboratories, where they are growing and testing and developing cannabis for medicinal purposes. The company has an application progressing, and they're happy with the way it's progressing with the Home Office as a research and development grower license, as well as this, as I say, the company's invested into Sativa Germany. There's a Swiss investment as well, and it has investments into Rapid Rose Therapeutics and Veritas Pharma in Canada, both of which have gone up by 4.5% in value on the current year. So in May, the company announced its full year results, turnover of 260,000, gross profit of 110,000, gross margin of 42,000, net assets of just under 5 million with cash of 3.7 million, and that's up from 2.6 million on the previous year. Since then, it's appointed broker Sencos, and in a trading update the other day, it announced that quarter one revenues for 2019 had exceeded total year revenues for last year. So that's an encouraging sign. Revenues are really progressing here. The company is making strong progress. And the CEO, Jeremy Thomas, I think we spoke about this before, he owns a big chunk of the company, I think over 50% of the company. And at the when the company first came to market last year and raised 1.1 million, he put in nearly all of himself with 785,000 investments. So you were talking just now about CEOs not having skin in the game. This guy has got plenty of skin in the game. So, we've all heard about cannabis. We've all heard about cannabis.
What's it all about?
For medicinal purposes. Well, clearly, some people smoke it and are known as stoners,
really?
And others. Others use it for medicinal purposes, but there are a number of companies
on
the market.
Some people surely smoke it for medicinal purposes, do they?
They do.
Or that's what they tell. That's what they tell the police anyway.
That's right. Yes. He replied after caution. But yeah, there we go. But no, I think what I like about Sativa is it has, we were talking about one trick ponies earlier. Like ECR Minerals have a broad spectrum and range of licenses to mine. Sativa have a range of investments. So companies they wholly own. So they're developing the product and growing the product in the UK, and they have investments into other countries too. So there's a good spread of risk within the industry, and clearly if cannabis is your thing, then this is probably one of the very best companies to be involved with.
Well, who knows? That's the wonder of investing. Anything else worth chatting about, Al?
The wonder of investing. Yeah, well, we mentioned feedback last week,
do you know what? Someone said on Twitter, said, right, I've stopped subscribing now because Justin's obviously pushing his own stocks and doesn't like anything else. No. I'm considering feedback. Like I said, it doesn't tick. It ticks tech. It ticks my box. Small cap ticks my box. CEO doesn't have skin in the game. Doesn't tick my box. And I always say this. CEOs are corporate animals. They are, at the head of the capitalist world, they're in it to make money and do well. And let's be honest, if any CEO, could earn a massive amount of money by investing in their own company because they know it's going to do well, they would, I think. And so I just think, why hasn't Tom Oakley, the CEO of Feedback, if he's under a winner here with this messaging system that's going to be adopted by the NHS and other kind of, why isn't he now buying shares? He may be in a closed period, of course, but I would like to see that. You know?
Well, also, just you're absolutely right, but Tom has only just joined. I mean, the Alistair Riddell has been running the company for years. He has skin in the game, and there are also some big shareholders in the company, like Tom Charlton, who've been involved with the company for years.
They were involved with the company before Bleeper came along. Now, to me, their old system they're championing for a long time, Texrad, hasn't won out, isn't getting attraction, and so those guys were holders on that sort of system. They're winning out, which is not winning out. But Tom has come in and say, right, we turn the business around. We're transitioning the business. We're pivoting, and Bleeper is the new thing we're going to go with. Anyone who gets, emotional about an investment because someone talks and gives an opposing view and gets emotional about that, loses. Will never be a good investor, full stop. And so I have some faceless idiot on Twitter, again, with no face, no real name, slagging me off.
Keyboard warrior, But the thing is, two opinions make a market. So you're absolutely right. You've got your opinion. They've got yours. They've got theirs. That's fine. That makes a market. But Tom has only just joined the company in relative terms. So he joined in March this year. Where he is right now, as you say, he could well be in a closed period. But I would fully expect him to get involved as a shareholder at some stage or, at the very least, take shares as part of his remuneration package, which he may already have. I'll need to check on his original announcement when he joined. But regardless, I think there is still Texrad, which of course is the medical imaging software which can identify tumours and other conditions that the naked eye can't see. So that's already in the system. But I think with Bleeper, they're actually bringing the whole offering together, and that's what I like about it.
I know, but let me say one thing, right? People are saying, and I said this last time we talked about this, people are talking about this and the share price rose as if it's a done deal. It is not a done deal. And,
of course it's not.
The person who's over emotional is, regardless of what you think, if you are invested in the stock, you are biased, full stop. I am not invested in the stock. I do like the idea, but like I said, there's it's not a done deal, and there's a lot more chance of it not happening than there is happening, because at the moment, you have to, national adoption across NHS is a massive thing.
It's a huge thing.
The bureaucracy and all that stuff, and getting everyone together, it's a fragmented sort of market. And again, 97% at the moment use WhatsApp. People saying, it's illegal, though. It's not illegal. It may be made illegal, but they've only just outdated faxes. And that was...
Yeah,
look how long faxes... the rest of the world haven't been using faxes for like 20 years or 15 years. And it's just, they only just outdated them. So how slow does that move, the regulatory sort of process in that move? And not only that, like I said... This is, they've got a CE mark for a medical device, so they can transfer images. I don't think most of the communications the doctors carry out, nurses, whatever, they don't send images. I honestly believe it's text. So, you have the internal email system for images. What's wrong with that? So people assuming that at the moment that they're using systems at the moment. So to get them to adopt a completely different system, right, is a massive thing. It's not a done deal. So in my mind, it's better to be cynical than assume it's a done deal. It's obvious.
I beg to differ, actually. I have a friend that works at the Montefiore Hospital in Hove, and they do use WhatsApp, but they are using images that they are emailing themselves and sending around the system and getting onto WhatsApp, and clearly that is not secure.
Ask your mate, of the last, say, 100 messages you've sent, how many images were them? How many images on WhatsApp?
He's a doctor. I asked him. He said we send images all the time. So
just ask him. The last 100 images. That's a percentage. Then last 100 images. Last 100 communications you sent on WhatsApp.
He said we send them all the time. He said we send images all the time.
I want a data-driven answer. I don't want just an opinion.
I'll ask him, get a number. But he's one doctor, so you're right. Others could send texts. But I think you're missing the point. The point is that the CADRAN system is already embedded into the NHS network.
Hang on, you're missing it. So surely email, they've got email on their mobile devices.
Well, they've got email, yes.
So why can't they send, and that's secure, why can't they send images via email?
they've got email on their medical devices, but the point is with a messaging system, it's instant, isn't it? That's the whole point. So if you've got
email is seconds, if you can send an email and take seconds.
But the point is, it's got to go through a server. The email has to go through a server, and if there's a breakdown in the server or whatever, an email will take longer. A WhatsApp message is instant. Look, I'm not saying this is the utopian answer to everything. I'm just saying there's a very strong case, and also the fact that CADRAN is already embedded within the NHS at Petworth Hospital, that's key to this. That is key because it's already integrated into the system. So they're already dovetailing into that.
I like that idea. It's definite plus. So I'm there on that. Like I said, listen, in my mind, right, it's got to tick several boxes. One is that I'm happy to wait until the deal's done. It'll spike like hell, but then I know there's very little risk going forward then. And I'll wait for it to come back a bit. It'll spike and the share price will come back. But I'm waiting to see some kind of evidence that it's going to be adopted, rather than just go on a punt and say it is going to be adopted on rumour and all that stuff. So yep. I like the tech. I like the size of the company. I watched the interview with Tom. He seems quite a sharp guy. I'd like to see him take more skin in the game. Again, if he's on the inside, he can't do that. But I'll wait for the evidence that's going to be adopted, because there are people just suggesting it's a done deal. I think don't get too carried away. Where people lose money in investments, they're carried away.
We have the expert at Manchester next month, and that's when it's first actually exposed to the medical community in a formal way. And the feedback from that will be the feedback from that will be very very interesting, because that's obviously the first step into the public domain for Bleeper, or certainly into the NHS domain. So yes, it is not a done deal by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm just excited by it. I think. Actually, that with Bleeper, the feedback for the first time has got something that actually brings the entire offering together. And that was what Tom said he was going to do when he first joined the company in March. He was going to look at the company, assess the strategy, and see if they needed to change direction strategically. And Bleeper is the answer to that. I can see that. But let's see what happens.
It'd be amazing if this guy just comes in as CEO, finds a solution, and straight away with in weeks, they've got a multi-million pound deal. I mean, that to me, that sounds too good to be true. It doesn't normally happen like that,
You're right. It doesn't normally happen like that. But sometimes you can be at the coalface so long you can only see things a certain way, and it does take someone to come in from outside and say, "Hey, that's great, but why not try this?" And innovative CEOs can do that. But let's see what happens. Anyway, I think we've covered this now.
Let's do another half an hour. Alistair Riddell has 1.8% shares. That's yes. all. Simon Sturge, who bought a big chunk, a while back, got 3.4%. There's no director there with apart from Simon Sturge, with more than three. Dr. Alistair Riddell has been championing this company for ages. He's more than 1.8% of the company, So there we are. There we are. If this was a new big thing, wouldn't he pile up? Wouldn't he load up? Load up.
Load up.
I think he's waiting.
Load up. Indeed. Yeah. Okay.
So, anything else?
Thomas Cook? No. Let's not.
Thomas Cook, I do not see.
Astonishing. Can you believe that a Turkish Turkish.
You sold at the loss, though. Why didn't you hold on for the Turkish Cook?
I should have sold on. Yeah, but
nature of trading.
Of course it is. Yeah, I made a loss. I can live with that. I'll make it up somewhere else. So that is what it's about. But it's, you never stop learning. But one other little mover that's caught my eye this week is Petrol Resources, PET.
Oh, not that pump. go on.
Oh, my goodness.
Go on.
Okay, so very quickly, there's an interest in the Southwest Island Woodside, the Frontier Exploration Licence in Southwest Ireland, where it has a stake alongside Woodside Energy. It has a 30% licence in the Tano 2 block just off the coast of Ghana, and there are are political issues in Ghana that have basically prevented this from, should we say...
Let me just say one thing, right, before I go. I don't know about the initial investment here, but are they still in Ghana, or are they looking at other things?
They're looking at other things. I'm just basically coming down the list. That's an onshore / offshore license to access the oil, and there is extensive oil seepage in the block as well. So clearly, it looks ripe for drilling and extracting. They also have an interest in the Western Desert Block 6 in Iraq, close to in the Mergen oil field, and they have just appointed a chap called Riyad Hamid as a new non-exec to help establish Baghdad operations. He's got extensive experience in that region. July 30th, the company raised 560,000 euros in the placing at 1.25 cents. My apologies. That placing basically took up 29.9% of the shares in the company. Roger Tamraz and Michael Fayed each came in with 10% each in that raising. Since then, the share price has gone berserk, and I'm intrigued because we did speak about this. I held shares in the company, and then nothing happened. I basically sort of just got out where I got in, more or less. But that was at about 1.5, 2p. The share price has rocketed since then, and is currently sitting at 4.7p, with a much chunkier market cap than it had beforehand. And it's clearly, the activities being undertaken by the company have fired the interest and the imagination of some of the shareholders that have just
imagination.
Dropped.
Yes, I'd say that imagination's run wild.
So the imagination's run wild. Now, I'm not saying anything about this. I don't own shares in the company, but it's just intrigued me because this was a company I owned, and there seems to have been a disproportionate movement in light of what was a fairly modest raising.
I mean, I've heard rumours about the billionaires coming on board in millions. So where they are they in Iraq and Ghana? Is that where they're at?
They have a licensed interest off Southwest Island. They're in Ghana, which is that's the key. That Tano 2 block, the onshore offshore block, the other 60% is owned by Clontarf Energy. Do you remember we had this conversation? This must be last year now, goodness me. It also has the interest in Iraq, but as I said, they've appointed Riyad Hamid as a new non-exec to help develop the merchant oil field interest and the Baghdad operations over there. So, yeah, clearly operations are expanding. The company said that it was making progress with the Ghanaian government in regard to progressing the developments of the Tano 2 block, but clearly, it seems to be more or less where it was last year. But there has been this movement. Is it billionaires coming in? Is it big investors coming in? Who knows? As a market watcher, I get intrigued by stuff like this. And because once held the shares, it was flagged up on my watch list.
It's a trade that people sort of pump on Twitter to get 10-20%, or it may go better than that. But let's be honest, Ghana and Iraq. What jurisdictions? Yes. If you had a choice of jurisdictions in the world, those would be the top two, wouldn't they? Iraq and Ghana.
Well, you
Ghana.
Said that.
Listen. Yeah. I had a very successful oil and gas guy on right, and I asked him about Ghana. He relinquished a license there because he said it's such hard work. He said Ghana and not it's a horrible jurisdiction. The government dragged their heels for years. In the end, we just got out. And he's now producing, and I'm going to tell who they are, but their share price has pretty much 10 bagged in the last 3 years, and they are dealing with some majors now.
But then you've got Gulf Keystone Petroleum, which is Kurdistan, which is...
But look what happened to them.
Yeah, look what happened to them, but they're on the way back, aren't they?
Exactly. If you can be put up with, 10 years of lost money and the threat of going through, fair enough. Because, I mean, look at the share price on Gulf Keystone. It's gone, from, where was it, 20 quid? It's gone, and it went down to, 70 pence? And now it's back up to 2 quid. So it's not, Depends.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a risky old business. But
all over the place. All over the place.
Yeah, oil and gas in dodgy jurisdictions. That's oil and gas is risky on its own. But you put that together with a dodgy jurisdiction, you know, where there's going to be war happening, then you've got a whole set of new risks coming on board. Anyway.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Okay, Marvellous. Anything else, Al?
That's it for me for now, Jess.
Of all those shares, I'm most interested in feedback, but you have to be cynical, because when you get involved, when you buy a stock, right, you become biased. So it's good to be cynical and be objective before you get in. When you get in, everything else is confirmation bias. You know, anything that happens, that's good news. It's like, because you bought shares. Any other news comes out. So, exactly.
Because you're emotionally attached to it, whether you admit it or not. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So it's good to get, good to be, you know, very subjective, or try and be objective, but be a bit cynical before you get in, because, you know, that's when the best time, where the risks are. Marvellous stuff. Al, thanks for that. And we'll catch up next week, fella.
Cheers, Jess. Speak next week.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. Digital Box at 5.9%. I had the guy on the podcast a while back. I quite like the concept of small market cap, but as yet, the revenue generation wasn't there. I thought, I'll wait. It's on my watch list. D-Box, I don't know if it ever will be there, but we'll see. At four, Block Energy. That's BLOE on the podcast yesterday, Paul was. At three, Polarian Imaging, POLX. I do like that company. Like I said, I talked about them yesterday, last night on the video. Just check out YouTube, and there's quite a few things there that they've said. You know that I don't think people understand that their clinical phase 3 trials. Normally, it's, I think, just less than 50-50 chance of going from phase 3 to passing that for drugs. This is a different kind of phase 3. It's very low risk, but the potential benefits are still very big. Check it out, POLX, Polarian Imaging, and do a search on YouTube for my video on that. At two, Agronomics, ANIC. And another big bit of news coming up from UN experts saying we need to reduce our meat consumption to help to reduce global warming, essentially. So we know this, environmental, it's better for health. I just think it's a meta trend, a mega theme that is set to continue for years. That's ANIC Agronomics, so supporting that investment company there. I've also done videos on that, so check it out. And number one most followed company is Burford Capital, punt of the week, by the looks of it. It fell off a cliff yesterday due to reporting issues and other things going on. A bit of controversy and people sort of catching that falling knife there. It's BUR. All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It'd help if there's numbers next to these, not. Block Energy. Preparation begins at West Rostavi for well 38Z or Z. At 4, ACP, I think it is, Armadale Capital. Exceptionally high purity metallurgical test work. Exceptionally. I always worry when companies put something really, you know, bullish, overly bullish in their title there, you know. It may work. I don't know. I'm not questioning the validity of that. Just I'm saying, you know, do you know what? If it's a company I own, I think good enough for them. Sometimes I think it's a bit rampy, though. At three, Iron Ridge Resources, corporate update, drilling for equity program MOU. At two, EVR Holdings, Melody VR signs licensing and publishing contracts. And number one, it's Ncondezi, most liked as a holdings RNS. Scott Fletcher from Manchester has gone up to 8.2% of the entire issued share stock of Ncondezi, so he's obviously quite confident there. I've no idea the story behind that gentleman, but he looks quite confident. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.